Howie Politics and State Affairs Pro offer insider election coverage, polling, and analysis in Indiana. Our nonpartisan news and legislative tools create a winning combination pro subscribers can't live without. For all the resources you need this election season and beyond, visit pro.stateaffairs.com/IN. That's pro.stateaffairs.com/IN.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
From Wish TV, this is All Indiana Politics Podcast with Phil Sanchez, unfiltered.
Welcome to a special edition of the All Indiana Politics Podcast and Unfiltered with Phil Sanchez. I'm Garrett Bergquist, filling in for Phil Sanchez, and joining us today is Republican candidate for governor Jamie Rittenour. Jamie, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Garrett.
So tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, whenever I was 26 years old, I got my first corporate job. I started as a secretary of the company, and then within the year, I was promoted to the second in charge of the second largest mortgage broker in California. My job was to be the compliance manager for the broker, which meant that it was my job to find out who was doing what was right and who was doing what was wrong. We were also over the fraud department. We worked with real estate loan officers specifically. I've had a lot of background in mortgage. I also was an athletic director. I've spent many years involved in women's ministry and kids ministry. I'm a worship leader. So I'm just a person that loves to work and serve people. And now I get to do that here in the state of Indiana.
So you mentioned you worked out in California. What brought you to Indiana?
Well, actually, I went from California to Michigan. So my dad is in the military. Actually, both of my parents serve in the military. So whenever people ask me, you know, where I'm from, that's always an interesting question. But my husband is from Michigan. So I married Nathan. We were in Michigan for some years. And then we went to Illinois, back to Michigan, and then came to Indiana. So we really were called out of Michigan. All of our family lives there. He has five siblings that live in Michigan, and my sister lives in Michigan as well. And so we were just in a time in our marriage where we just really wanted to live our faith. And so we prayed about it and felt like the Lord was calling us to the state of Indiana. So a little over 6 years, or going on the seventh year now, we moved to the state of Indiana, and it has been all good.
And now you are running for governor of Indiana. You're one of six Republicans running in the primary. Tell me about your decision to run.
Right. Well, I've said before, and I've said this all over the state of Indiana, I was never one that was ever interested in being involved in politics. My running for governor here in the state of Indiana comes from a calling. It's a calling that the Lord gave me over 6 years ago. I was in downtown Indianapolis, and I just heard a whisper over my ear, you're going to be the governor of the state of Indiana. I took it very serious. I went and studied. You can't be governor unless you've lived here five consecutive years. And so I waited. We went through COVID, which was a big learning experience for quite literally the world. During that time, we just continued to prayerfully consider what the Lord had said. I noticed that I was seeing people more in the state of Indiana, so all of a sudden my heart had kind of grown for the people of Indiana. And then after 4 years of the calling being on the shelf, I went to Panera with a prayer team lead, and a woman walked up and asked me, what does the Lord have to say to you? And she just said to me right there in the Panera that the Lord had given me a love. It was for people more than just my family, and I needed to walk in that love. And then the following week, I was with the same person, and a man walked up, and he said, God bless you to my friend. She said, God bless you. Jesus is Lord. He said, he is the Lord. He's the everlasting to everlasting. And then he asked her if she loved the Lord. She said, I do with all my heart. And he turned and looked at me, and he said, the people do not know how much the Father loves them. He gave his Son. And then he said, you have a calling on your life. It's a calling for your future. You need to let your past go. You need to walk in that calling and allow the Lord to renew your mind, that you might approve the pure and acceptable will of God. And So I went home. I got into the Word of God. I operate out of the book of Nehemiah. That's where I really feel the Lord guided me. In my study of Nehemiah, in the first chapter, it says the walls have been broken down and the gates have been burned with fire. And so what I submit to the people of the United States of America, and especially the Hoosiers, is that we are in the midst of a spiritual and moral crisis in our country. And I am just one that is called to serve the people and to return the power back into the hands of the people. The power is really the safest in the hands of the people. And then I always say in this order, if the people choose the Lord, then we'll see revival.
Your faith is clearly very important to you. Has it always been that way? Was there, did it gradually become a greater part of your life during adulthood?
Right. Well, I got saved when I was 13 years old. So I was raised in a Christian home, but my personal relationship with Jesus didn't start until I was 13. I actually went through a year of just being really depressed. I think a lot of kids can go through that during transition ages, whenever you're young and you're going from like eighth grade to ninth grade and you're just trying to learn yourself. And so I had this moment in time where I was just really struggling with depression, and the Lord was there for me. And I remember just asking him into my heart, telling him that I believed in him. And so I believe I was saved at 13, but I didn't really see my walk catch on fire for the Lord until I was in college. I got involved with a group called Campus Crusade for Christ. And so we did a lot of ministry, went to the inner cities. It was pretty amazing. And so that's really when my walk took off. And then I can say that since then, I have gone through many valleys. But I would say that what I've learned is how to dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. The Lord is faithful. And so my walk with Jesus is very real. I've seen him do supernatural things in my life that no one can explain. And so I'm very confident in my relationship with him. And I love that I bring that honesty to the conversation, because I'm not a religious person. I'm a person that believes in relationship, and there's a difference.
And speaking of your faith, you have a copy of the Bible with you right now. I know that you carry that a lot of places where you go. Tell me a little bit about that specific Bible you have with us.
Right. So this is my Bible. You know, it's torn on the back, and I thought about getting it, having them kind of redo the cover, but you get used to your Bible, and they're really, I don't know how to explain that except to say that I can tell exactly where in my Bible certain passages are just because I've used it for so long. Yes, I read the Word of God often. My family, my children, and my husband and I, we go through what's called the one-year Bible, which is really just a Bible that separates passages in such a way that whenever you go through the year, you've read the entire Bible. And so one of the things that we love is we're on our fourth year with our children going through the one-year Bible. My children know the Word. They speak the Word. It's very special for my husband and I. So yes, I love the Word of God. It is a treasure to me.
So let's talk a little bit about your run for governor. You use the slogan Indiana Goodness. Tell me a little bit about what that means.
Right. So Indiana Goodness is really, I think, something that a lot of people can identify with, especially coming out of COVID. I think that you know, there's a lot of conservatives and really you might even find Democrat, libertarians, people that have trusted, let's say, the system, the political system. We go, we vote, we believe that people are going to do what they say on stump. But when we ran into COVID, we really saw government overreach in an extreme way. And I think that it really, no matter which way people fall in COVID, because I've actually had some people in my family that passed away from COVID, so delicate subject. But what it did show us is just how far in government can go, how much overreach is actually allowed. And in the process of that, I think we have to look at ourselves. We have to do just some constructive criticism of our own involvement. And so Indiana Goodness is really this idea of do not be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. It's the heart of saying, you know, there are many problems, but we, the people, we can solve these problems. It's going to take involvement. So I run on truth, transparency, and engagement. Because the goal is not for me to get into office and everyone to say, okay, she's got all the answers, now I'm going to go back to my life. Like, no, that's why we are where we are. This is, the people need to get engaged in their government at all levels. That is when our country is going to be the strongest.
Let's talk about your plan for education. I understand you like to put a lot more emphasis on the trades at an earlier stage in the school process?
I do. I love that kids are oftentimes hands-on learners, and so we have our plan for K through 5, wanting to take technology out and emphasize on the core academics, and then sixth grade, we want to see adopt a classroom where the private sector comes in and answers the question, how has technology, innovation, AI affected your profession? So we want to raise the conversation for our sixth graders, because in 10 years, the workforce is going to change, and we want Hoosiers to be ready for that. You know, right now we have a 30 to 35% proficiency rate in our state in education. Third through eighth graders are not passing iLearn. We have like 130,000 third through eighth graders that haven't passed iLearn. And so this is really something that we don't see a lot of people that are running for governor speaking about. Nobody has an education plan. We've made it our emphasis. And we'd like to see trades, seventh and eighth graders, go back to having those workshop classes and sewing classes and cooking classes. I had that when I was younger. It was wonderful. And so we're going to bring that back in, and we'd love to see the private sector really adjust and get involved. Ninth grade, we're asking the question, college, career, or calling, and then senior year, we'd love to see every senior graduate completing an apprenticeship. It's going to take involvement from the private sector, but that's really the goal. Again, we're emphasizing on engagement because we believe that's Indiana goodness.
Are there any examples that you've already seen in certain schools scattered around the state that you'd like to incorporate statewide?
Definitely. Wabash is a city that is doing a fantastic job with their education. They already have internships that kids are involved in. They also have kids that are going to Ivy Tech. It's really surprising how many counties are involved in the internship Ivy Tech programs that are available. A lot of that is also just parent education. There's a lot of parents that have educated themselves on what's available for their seniors. So we just want to see the state of Indiana come together and do that together. We believe that we can be the training capital of the United States. We think that reflects the people of Indiana.
There's been a little bit of move toward this already over the past couple legislative sessions. There's been some effort to start career scholarship accounts in the legislature. There's this past legislative session, one of the big issues was the bill that starts reading exams in second grade instead of third grade, and then require some interventions and, if necessary, holding kids back if they still can't pass the end of third grade. What do you think of the things that the legislature has done so far toward those ends?
Well, I think that one of the things that we want to see the legislators do is talk to teachers. We want to see a whole lot more conversation with the teachers that are on the ground. We see that what's called climate audits have been taken away from teachers, where when schools were getting accredited, they would have climate audits where teachers could give their feedback. And so what we'd like to see is our legislators paying a lot more attention to the teacher's voice. We have heard that there was a movement to have all third graders held back at one point in time. We think that's unwise because every child is different. My head of education, Paige Miller, loves to look at each individual child, and what they do in K through second grade already is what's called progress monitoring. And so this is something that's very common in those grades, and so we'd like to see that taking place so that kids, when they're in that K through second grade time frame, they're already getting their foot in the door in a manner that fits where they are at in education. We don't want to move it all the way to third grade and then look at it as a crisis. We want to meet the need before it gets to that point. And so we'd like to see legislators asking teachers more about how they can do that. It's easy to put a bunch of laws out there, a lot harder to see those implemented.
Do you feel that the emphasis should be more on the traditional K through 12 public schools? Do you think it needs to be more on charter schools, private schools? Where do you fall on that debate?
Well, I don't know that it needs to be a debate. I think what we're doing is we're looking at the crisis, and we're trying to get to where we see the bleeding the most. Public school education right now is struggling. We do see that the private sector, the private schools, if you will, are doing better in some of their scoring. The charter schools are doing better in some of their scoring. And so what we're really trying to do is stop the bleeding. We don't want to see kids missed in any way, shape, or form. And so I think what they're going to find with my head of education is that because we are listening to the teacher's voice, we can do a whole lot faster than it would be if you were having a legislator just telling people what to do and making the rules and laws for them to do that. We are going to be on the ground. My head of education will not be brick and mortar inside the office all the time. She's going to be visiting high schools with her team so that she knows what's taking place on the ground. That's going to help all of us in the state move at the same time. I don't think it'll be broken up, public school this, charter school that. I think we're all going to move at the same time.
You've called for an audit of all the state agencies and potentially shutting some of them down. Tell me a little bit about which agencies you have in mind.
Well, we focus a lot on the IEDC. I'm studying the IEDC right now, the statutes, the Indiana Code that allows for that. They're rather shocking. The news should hang out there for a while. I am surprised that we have legislation that went through and gave such broad authority to the IEDC with such little accountability. So we are auditing from that perspective. We think that we see really the fruit of their labor, this $2 billion pipeline for LEAP, which is $20 million per county. I mean, that deserves to be looked at. So we look at the IEDC. We're also looking at the Department of Child Protective Services. We want to see our foster care, and that's really a broken system in the state of Indiana. And so we're looking very closely at that and how we can not just what people say is it's like putting duct tape on a system and expecting it to do well. And the kids that are affected in the foster care system are just, it's life-changing situations that they're going through. And it is not doing well in the state of Indiana. So we'd like to reassess the Department of Child Services and see what we can do with the private sector being involved. There's already some private contracts that are out there, and from what we've heard on the ground, a lot of those private contracts are doing a lot better. The private sector is doing a lot better than the government is in that specific area, so we're going to be looking hard at that as well.
How do you ensure, though, that if you do switch to a chiefly privatized child care services system, that those contractors are still meeting the basic needs of the children? How do you maintain oversight?
Well, they're doing it now, so it's possible because we know that there's so many private contractors that are involved right now. What we're saying is that the state has already created oversight. We're just saying that we probably need to outsource more. So we'll just take the system that they're using now and we'll broaden it so that it's over more people.
Returning to the IEDC issue for a minute, are you saying you would want to completely shut down the IEDC, or might you simply scale it back?
Well, Garrett, it's a hard question, because if you scale it back, then my name is on everything. And there's a lot that's going on that a lot of people, that Hoosiers in the state of Indiana, do not like. There is a lot of gray area that the IEDC has been operating in. And I don't want my name on that because I care about Hoosiers. And so it's not as easy as cutting the arm off, because as I said, I'm looking at Indiana Code. I mean, it's in Indiana Code. There's a statute that actually addresses the IEDC. And so what we're going to do is we're going to audit the IEDC. We're going to find out what's going on. The news is doing a great job of investigating the IEDC right now, which is wise. That's what the news should be doing. And so we're going to bring to the people of the state of Indiana all of our research, and we're going to put pressure on the legislature to change the statutes that involve the IEDC. Would I like to see the IEDC go away altogether? I would like to see that, because I do think a little leaven leavens the whole lump. And so whatever good is supposed to be taking place, I think we have to isolate that and start again. I think it's gone too far. I do think that they need to address it and repeal the statute and then create something that's going to be more about Hoosiers.
Let's talk taxes for a little bit. You've called for getting rid of or putting a cap on a number of property taxes. Tell me a little bit more about that.
65 and older, we want to see relieved of taxes. So we would like to see anyone that is 65 and older not have to pay property tax in the state of Indiana. These are people that oftentimes have paid off their mortgage. They lived on fixed income. And then we address first-time home buyers, or really home buyers, single-family homes, not having to worry about taxes being raised. So like a fixed tax rate we think would be good for them. And then we're looking at Hawaii. Hawaii has a property tax rate of 0.11. Would we like to see the state of Indiana go to zero property tax? Well, Hoosiers would like to see that. That's just the reality. That's the conversation that's taking place on the ground. It's prevalent. It's everywhere in the state of Indiana. It's not easy to do because you have to reallocate funds to all the different counties, but that's why on May 8th, I plan on going around to every single county and having this conversation on the ground. We want to have a local conversation about taxes. I don't know how anyone, I mean, you're not going to axe the tax. That's totally not true. I don't know how anyone is having a tax conversation without acknowledging that it's got to be a conversation that's talking to local level as well as the state level. And so we're going to have that conversation, and we're going to hold the people accountable for their solutions in their local areas, because that's truth, transparency, and engagement, and that's what we run on.
And you just alluded to one of your opponents in this campaign, Suzanne Crouch, who's proposed eliminating the state income tax entirely. So you would not necessarily endorse that?
I'd love to see her plan. We've yet to see it. Every time she mentions that, she walks it back two sentences later. So whenever I see a plan, I'll comment on it. But there's no plan. Right now, it's just ax the tax. It's a gimmick. So just give us the plan, and then we'll make a comment.
You've made clear that you very strongly oppose abortion. Now, right now, under Indiana law, there's basically no access to abortion other than very, very limited exceptions for cases of rape or incest, or if the mother's life or health are in danger. Would you ask lawmakers to get rid of those exceptions?
So I'm a person that believes in life. I don't start the conversation that circumstances, because I believe in the God of life. And so I start the conversation in the beginning, like it says in Genesis. And so a lot of times people will say to me, do you feel like people are going to be upset with you? But I don't take that as people being upset with me. I believe in God as creator. And so really people are upset with him. When it comes to exceptions being made, I just encourage people to do their homework on that. The gestation age of abortion in 2023 was higher than prior years. And so it's just good for us to know how many abortions took place in 2023. It's not as simple as, we just got rid of abortion. It didn't happen that way. The numbers reveal that there were many abortions that took place in 2023. So again, I'm grieved by life being dismissed. It's something that means a lot to me, and I'm not just a person that's for life in the womb. I'm a person that's for life for Hoosiers, and I introduce a principle that people know well. It's not just a biblical principle. It's a farming principle, and it's the principle that you reap what you sow. And so I say to the state of Indiana, let's sow life and reap life.
So, but would you ask the legislature to get rid of those exceptions then?
Oh, absolutely. I'm for no exceptions when it comes to life.
Even if the mother's health is at serious risk of harm?
So in those situations, really the doctor approaches the situation just looking at both as patients. And so we would trust the doctor as he looks at both the mother and the baby as a patient in that situation.
You know, we talked a little bit about your opposition to abortion, and some have incorporated that into what's been referred to as the consistency of life ethic, where I oppose abortion, therefore I also oppose capital punishment. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I mean, it would be interesting to hear where people are getting that stance. Are they gathering that from, like, a biblical perspective? Because I'd love to know, like, the verse that they're referencing. That's helpful. When we look at capital punishment in Scripture, what I do is I take people to when Jesus died on the cross. He was actually on the cross in between two thieves. And one thief was saying, if you're really the Lord, take us down from here. But the other thief said, this man doesn't deserve to be here. We do. He doesn't. And he said to the Lord Jesus, remember me. And the Lord said to him, you will be with me today in paradise. And so importantly, like, they weren't taken down from the cross. And so do I think that capital punishment can exist? I do. But I also believe in a hope that's eternal. I believe that people are given second chances. And so when people ask me for a government solution, I pray for wisdom and I give them what I believe are wise solutions. When people ask me for hope, I point them to Jesus.
And also, since we're on the topic of life, during this past legislative session, there was a lot of controversy over the Family and Social Services Administration's decision to discontinue the attendant care program for families of medically complex children. And I should point out that this resulted after they discovered that they would be short almost $1 billion on their Medicaid funding. So that will become effective on July 1st. How would you approach that? Would you pursue another solution for those families?
So if I was in office when that happened, we would be having a news press conference on that. And I would be pointing out to Hoosiers that we've got $2 billion going to fix a pipeline. But when we lost $1 billion, our first thing that we wanted to do was take it from these families that are in very vulnerable positions. That's your typical government solution. I would have condemned that. I do, however, also believe in less government and lower taxes. And so I'm a big, big fan of nonprofit organizations in the private sector. You know, we are very giving people in the United States of America. You saw that with the Ukraine war. There was a lot of money that we were giving as a government, but there was also a whole lot of money and time that was being given from missionaries and churches that were sending money to Ukraine just on their own. And so the people of America, specifically the Hoosiers, we are a giving people. And so I encourage people to be involved, especially in the private sector and nonprofit organizations. I know of a few. The Sky's the Limit is one of them that I'm thinking of right now. A young girl that started a nonprofit for her nephew. And so it's just, it's things like that that I think that we as community need to get behind and really provide long-lasting solutions that go far and extend government.
What's your plan for dealing with the overdose crisis, particularly fentanyl?
Well, I think drugs and violence are really evidence of broken families. And so I have worked hard in this 2.5 year period of time to build relationships with pastors and community, people that are a part of nonprofits. Even when it comes to people that need food, there's a whole lot of pantries all over Indiana. So what I do is I really look at the home. I go to the home. I definitely would support our police, and I know that there is surely a battle that's raging on the streets. But I do believe that it's wise to address the issue at the root. We have broken families, and we need to encourage family. I don't necessarily, again, see that as a government solution. I'm just a person willing to work. And so what people are going to find with me that they will not find with another politician is that I'm going to come to the table with where I think government should be involved, but then I'm going to give up my personal time to point people to what I believe is community helping community. And that's really what's going to change our state.
How would you encourage that, though? You talk about trying to repair broken families.
Mentorships go a long way. Just kids being able to be mentored. And there are many places all over the state of Indiana where kids can go and they can be mentored. I think that we probably could see more involvement by people that are serving in the private sector, people that are in government just on their own time, going out and being able to mentor kids. I think that would make a huge impact. Curtis Hill's always talking about the letters that he writes as former attorney general. Well, it'd be nice if he would go and be in some neighborhoods and walk around because kids are really impacted when people actually spend time with them one-on-one. So it is a calling for people to go the extra mile, but that's what we believe represents Indiana goodness, and that's what Hoosiers deserve.
I'm going to go into the weeds here a little bit. You've said that you want to bring a form of passenger rail back to Indiana to connect and develop small towns. Tell me a little bit about that.
Garrett, we're really excited about this. It takes a lot of hard work. We are doing our research. We've looked at Northeastern, which is up in the northern side of Indiana, and kind of what they're doing with industrial rail. But we would like to see the small towns in Indiana connected. I guess you could think of it like you have in Kentucky, the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. We would like to see the Indiana Goodness Train in the state of Indiana. It's really a difference in the opinion as to the trajectory of the state. This current administration and a lot of the people that support the IEDC, Brad, Eric, they really lean towards AI and taking the state of Indiana in that direction. I just personally don't believe that's what the state of Indiana needs. I don't think that's who she is. There are segments of the state of Indiana that would be great in innovation and technology, but that's not the entire state. She's not a one-size-fits-all. And so we really look at every area of the state of Indiana. We'd like to see our small towns, by the way. They're not just small. They're like under 1,000. Small towns connected with the Indiana Goodness Train, where you'd have like a coffee shop and a kitchenette where schools, universities could come and bring their culinary arts departments in, do tastings. And then when you go from small town to small town, we would only do tastings on the train so that those towns would then be able to do the breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so we're looking at the possibility of something like that. We're also looking in Gary, Indiana at the airport and what can maybe come of the airport there. So we're trying to look at every aspect of the state, which is not what the IEDC is doing.
So right now, as I mentioned earlier, there are 6 different candidates, including yourself, running in the Republican candidate for governor. What makes you the best choice out of that entire field?
I am for Hoosiers. I am not here to promote myself. I'm not here to promote my career. I am here for Hoosiers. I've gone around the state, spent my time, not money, my time, away from my family so that I could better understand what it is that the Hoosiers needed. What's so important is that each state is different. So we're not going to act in our state the same way that happens in Florida or Texas or Arkansas, although we do agree with many of their policies, and we'll probably echo some of those policies. We want to look at the state of Indiana and her people. She's a hardworking state. There's many people here cross-culturally that are so committed to their families. It's a generational state. My father-in-law, actually, his family, they are original settlers in the state of Indiana. And so we want to see family promoted in our state. If you want a family environment in your state, you have to attract families. And so we're really emphasizing on the things that we believe will attract families to the state of Indiana. We know that business has its place, and we're going to pay attention to that as well. But we are looking at Indiana for who she is, and we believe that is Indiana goodness, and that's what separates us from every single politician that's running. I am truly the only outsider, and I think Hoosiers are ready for that.
Jamie Rittenour, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you, Garrett.
That was Jamie Rittenour, Republican candidate for governor of Indiana. The primary is on May 7th. If you are not registered to vote and you want to vote in the primary, you have until April 8th to register. Early voting begins on April 9th. And be sure to check out all of our other podcast interviews with the rest of the Republican governor field, as well as other candidates running in different races in the primary, on the All Indiana Politics podcast on our website, wishtv.com. I'm Garrett Bergquist. Thank you for joining us.
From Wish TV, this is All Indiana Politics Podcast with Phil Sanchez. Unfiltered, in-depth, nonpartisan coverage, exclusive interviews with Indiana's political leaders. Subscribe to this podcast and listen weekly here on the All Indiana Podcast Network. And be sure to discover even more great podcasts at allindianapodcastnetwork.com.